to the Parlay podcast at The Hindu. I'm Suhasini Heather. This month, Sri Lankan protesters pushed out the government of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapakse, certainly forced the hand of the president there. But that isn't the only big political, non-electoral change in the neighborhood in 2021-22. Just a month ago, it was Pakistan. Some months before that, Nepal. And then there were these two changes by force that we saw in 2021 in Myanmar and then in Afghanistan. How should India tackle the changes in its region? With me, two of our foremost experts on the history and the diplomacy of South Asia, former Foreign Secretary, former Chair of the National Security Advisory Board, Shyam Saran, is an author, and his latest book, How China Sees India, is just out. And we're joined by Professor Srinath Raghavan. He's a professor at Ashoka University, author of several books, including India's War, The Making of Modern South Asia. And it's a real pleasure to welcome you on The Hindu's The Parley podcast. Thank you, Ambassador Saran. Thank you, Professor Raghavan.
My pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to be here, Suhasini.
I want to begin by asking both of you, and maybe Ambassador Saran, you could go first. Are these changes, and you know, I listed five countries in South Asia that have seen what I call non-electoral political changes. Are these changes in these five countries connected in any way? Is it because there have been similar political cultures, or is it because they're all facing the strain of the economic crisis in every country of the region?
I would say a bit of both, but perhaps I would place more emphasis on really the external environment, a much more challenging external environment, which all of us are confronting. I know there has been 2 years of COVID and the disruptions that it has caused, not only in terms of our economies, but also social disruptions. You have also more recently the impact of crises taking place in Europe. And given the fact that we are today such a globalized and interconnected world, and South Asia is not an exception, I am not surprised that each of our countries has had to deal with these rather unexpected challenges. And in some cases, several challenges have come together to cause a kind of a perfect storm. I would also say that a certain brittleness of the politics of some countries has made the whole effort to cope with these kind of external challenges much more difficult. So to that extent, the aspect that you mentioned, is there something in terms of the nature of political dispensations in these countries which can perhaps explain the severity of the challenge that they are facing? And in that respect, I would say that yes, the kind of brittleness, as I said, of these countries to deal with these challenges is one very important factor.
Right, very interesting. Professor Raghavan, there is on the one side, and Ambassador Saran has put it maybe diplomatically when he says there's a brittleness, but essentially this idea that South Asia has turned in a much more authoritarian direction. If you look at any of the EIU indexes, Freedom House indexes, South Asia is there declining year on year when it comes to the quality of its democracies. Do you think that is more responsible, less responsible, equally responsible as the economic crisis that we just spoke about?
I think the political brittleness that Ambassador Saran went through and the sort of democratic backsliding that, all these reports have been talking about forms the underlying condition for the crisis across the region that we are seeing. There has certainly been an erosion of democratic norms, procedures. There has been an attempt by executives in various countries to assert their control over other agencies within the state to sort of, devolve power more towards the center away from federal sort of arrangements and so on. And all of this has meant that, the style of politics that now seems to prevail across the region is a certain form of authoritarian populism, if I may put it that way. And when you overlay this kind of a change across the region over the past few years with the economic crisis, and the economic crisis is an important one. In fact, I would say that the only parallel that I can think of in recent history is the 1970s, when we had a similar kind of a global economic shock triggered by, you know, the oil sort of embargoes after the Arab-Israeli War in 1973, which had effects across practically every South Asian country, including India. And I think we are seeing a similar sort of a set of linked problems coming out of this current economic situation, coming out of the pandemic, the Ukraine war, and other factors. And when you put these together, which is to say a democratic backsliding, a turn towards authoritarian populism, alongside an economic crisis, then what you find is that there are very similar kinds of protests and forms of popular mobilization which are taking place across the region. So I think, yes, there is something to be said about the sort of pan-South Asian quality of what we are seeing now. Though obviously, you know, the specifics of the political economy of each country tends to differ.
All right. And certainly there is the Indian case itself, where we are seeing signs of democratic backsliding. We are seeing signs of an economic crisis. Yet it is no way at the juncture that we have seen maybe the smaller South Asian countries already facing these crises. But we've seen these similar challenges. And both of you have spoken about the fact that there are common threads in the countries facing the COVID pandemic, the global downturn, and now the impact, the inflationary impact of the Ukraine war. And yet, apart from a few furtive attempts, it seems there's been no collective response to these challenges. Ambassador Sarin, would you agree that actually there is a failure in this of South Asia becoming some kind of a collective in responding to so many similar crises?
Well, this is something which has been a continuing challenge, you know, how to try and fashion some kind of a, you know, cooperative, collaborative, regional response to very common challenges that South Asia has been facing. And in that respect, you know, the only country which can actually take the lead in order to formulate collaborative responses, mobilize that kind of regionalism, is only India. And I think the great, to me, a great sort of absence is precisely of that awareness, number one, and the willingness to perform that role. Now, you know, you see that India has essentially, it seems, given up on SAARC. Attention now focused much more on BIMSTEC. There have been, yes, sub-regional, you know, cooperation under, say, the BBIN, that is the Bhutan, Bangladesh, India, Nepal, you know, forum. But it is partial, you know. And so as far as the regional response is concerned, I'm afraid that simply does not exist. Even the limited kind of consultative process that we used to have before, even that is missing. So this is a failure. There is no other way to describe it, because you know, if India does not take the lead, it will not happen. That's the way it is. We are now, as you can see, working much more on the bilateral level rather than trying to see whether there are regional dimensions also which can be explored.
Interesting, Srinath, would you agree?
I would agree in terms of what Ambassador Sarin is saying about the absent sort of leadership of India in this context and why that matters. But I also think that it's important to point out that, you know, there is a wider deficit as well. I mean, if you compare, say, the 2000s with the 2010s and, you know, the decades since, to me, what is also striking is the level to which even civil society interaction across the region has considerably dipped. I think, you know, there was never a time when you could say that, you know, there was a pan-South Asian kind of, you know, civil society interaction, which was very strong. But certainly, even from the previous sort of levels, we have seen a significant erosion of this and an inward turn amongst civil society organizations. So we are at a, you know, curious juncture where neither high politics nor civil society interaction seems to be going on. But what is to me striking is that, you know, popular movements and mobilizations do seem to be learning a little bit from each other. I mean, for instance, the current protests in Sri Lanka clearly have taken a lesson or two out of what happened with the farmers' protests in India. So there are these kinds of learnings which are happening. But absent high political and civil society engagement, there is clearly a vacuum in the region.
All right. But interestingly, if you turn that around, unlike in the past when there was a lot of talk of India's muscular diplomacy, whether it was in Sri Lanka, whether it was the blockade in Nepal, whether it has been the tough talking with Pakistan, unlike in the past, in these cases, and we've seen these five changes in the region, India is not being blamed. India is not in any way being held responsible, even by the conspiracy theorists of the region. Is this about a shift in diplomacy? Is it about deft diplomacy? Or does it point to something more difficult for India? Is it about irrelevance, Professor Raghavan?
You're certainly right. I mean, I think there was a dynamic where many of the changes in the region used to be sort of traced back to some kind of an Indian hand. But I think, you know, part of the problem as far as India is concerned, and this is something that Ambassador Saran alluded to earlier, is I think we have been far too reactive in the way that we've thought about the region. You know, there has been a lot of talk about saying we want to put neighborhood first, but both our conception of what we consider to be the neighborhood and what we are willing to do there, I think has been far too much driven by involvement of external players like China. In a sense, we have been in a reactive mode for pretty much the bulk of the period of the current government. And I think that has in some ways, ensured that, yes, we've kind of managed to not make too many foolish moves, though we have made steps from time to time. But at the same time, we've ceased to be the kind of proactive player within the region that we historically were and should be.
All right. Ambassador Saran, do you think neighborhood first was the right step by the Modi government and it continues to adhere to it? Or has it been a little hollow?
Well, neighborhood first is not just Modi policy. I mean, neighborhood first, is something that was inaugurated even in the UPA government. So that is something which is a continuity. And I do think that the policy approach itself is a very sound approach to the neighborhood. I keep repeating, and maybe I should repeat again, that I have always said that unless you get your periphery right, unless you are able to manage your neighborhood well, you cannot in an optimal manner, either pursue a regional policy in Asia or even a global policy. You'll always be, drawn back to the subcontinent because of, if there is unrest or crises taking place in your immediate neighborhood, that draws you back. So the approach that we have is in executing good neighborhood, the kind of resources that we should devote to that, the kind of attention which we should devote to our neighbors, that is something which is, leaves something to be desired. Our attention to the, neighborhood in some sense continues to be somewhat episodic. So if something happens, if some crisis occurs, then we get very involved with that. When things, improve, relatively speaking, our attention then slips from the neighborhood. So you need continuous high-level, multi-level engagement with the neighborhood to really make certain that your good neighborhood policy yields the results that you want.
All right. You, in fact, said that, there is a kind of vacuum of leadership in South Asia. So if I could turn to the other powers that are maybe making some moves. The first is, of course, China. In a sense, COVID made China close its boundaries. Its own struggle with the pandemic has certainly cast doubts about the Chinese system, about Chinese abilities. But on the other hand, China began a new outreach of sorts, which was considered in the past, it would never have done, where it actually made an outreach to South Asia. Practically every country except for India was included in this plan for a COVID response, poverty alleviation center that they set up, distribution of vaccines. Even a country like Bhutan has taken Chinese vaccines over there when India had to stop its supply. Do you think that is continues to be a kind of a challenge to India? How has India fared, in a sense, in terms of its pushback to China in the neighborhood?
you know, one thing that is very clear is that China has far more resources to deploy than India has. So there is a certain asymmetry in terms of what resources that we can really devote to our good neighborhood policy. But having said that, I would also like to point out that if you are looking at what has been happening over the last several months, one, because of Chinese preoccupation with its own challenges, in particular, what is happening with, this zero COVID policy, the economic disruptions which are taking place, there is even a certain degree of, political, I won't say unrest, but certain political, stirrings which are taking place in China. So China is very much preoccupied with that domestic situation. It is also today very much preoccupied with the consequences and the anticipated consequences of the Ukraine war. Has it made a wrong bet in allying itself in a sense much more closely with Russia? So because of these preoccupations and because of the economic disruptions, the attention being given to not just South Asia, but to other parts of the world as well, this is something which is beginning to show up. Also, I would say that in South Asia itself, there is a certain new wariness about, the China connection. It may be unfair to hold China responsible for example, the economic crisis which is taking place in Sri Lanka. It may be unfair also to say that, China's Belt and Road project or the CPEC in Pakistan has not quite worked out the way it was supposed to. It was supposed to be a game changer for Pakistan. It has not been a game changer. It has created its own adverse consequences. So there is a certain kind of I won't want to exaggerate it, but there is a certain wariness about China. And to that extent, I have also argued that perhaps if we play our cards well, there is a certain opening, not a very big opening, but there is a certain opening for India to emerge as a kind of a security provider, as a kind of an economic support to the countries which are in the middle of the crisis. So, perhaps that's one way of looking at it.
Right. Professor Raghavan, that question has been asked about China in many ways and how China has emerged 2 years into the pandemic, also 2 years after it began its transgressions at the line of actual control. And Ambassador Sarin is making the point that, in fact, China has suffered reputationally and perhaps in terms of the bets it has made. But on the other side, some would say that China is a beneficiary. It is no longer enemy number one when it comes to the West. The West is certainly, even though they might make statements about China, are wholly focused on dealing with Russia. In a sense, in the Asian context and as a result, the South Asian context, China has fewer rivals. Where would you see China vis-a-vis 2 years ago?
In the short term, I think the Chinese are certainly in a tight spot, as Ambassador Sarin was explaining. I think the COVID and its economic consequences for China are pretty grim at this point of time. The internal political sort of situation, especially with the Party Congress and the centenary of the CCP, etc., has kept them quite preoccupied. But if you look ahead, if you look, say, towards the rest of the decade, I would imagine that actually we'll see a more sort of outward-looking China, especially in the areas of the Belt and Road. See, the BRI certainly has taken a hit because the Eurasian part of it now is in sort of, free fall. Everything to the west of Russia is unlikely to be part of any kind of connectivity which is led under Chinese control for the near future. But that creates an incentive then for the Chinese to double down on other parts of the BRI. I think the Chinese will also be learning certain kinds of lessons from what has happened to Russia as a consequence of the Ukraine war, particularly the manner in which Russia's dollar reserves in terms of sovereign assets have been more or less wiped out by a mouth to the mouse. Chinese wouldn't want a similar situation to befall them. And I'd imagine that the only way out of that kind of situation is to diversify into actual physical investments in other parts. And the logical conclusion would be to look closer to the BRI areas. And as you were saying, many of these countries are going to be facing a severe economic crisis. coming out of the effects of the pandemic, the Ukraine crisis, the global inflation. And at this point of time, it's not very clear that even forums like G20 have any clear plan for debt rescheduling, et cetera, for many of these countries. And in this context, I think China remains an important alternative. How much ever, as Ambassador Saran says, you know, its presence might be resented in certain quarters, I think it remains a default option when it comes to economic aid for many of these countries. So I wouldn't write off China so quickly.
And certainly, in some cases, we've seen that interest being renewed in the region. Professor Raghavan, you've also written in your book, Fierce Enigmas, which is really about the U.S.'s history with South Asia, about the U.S.'s ebb and flow, if you like, in its interest in India's neighborhood. But in the last year, we have seen the U.S. come back very hard with its MCC plan, the Millennium Challenge Cooperation Plan for Nepal, a very high-level visit to Bangladesh after a very long time, a new defense agreement with the Maldives as well. Do you see U.S. in South Asia today as a kind of force multiplier for India's efforts or a rival to China and, in a sense, to India?
I think it is a good thing that the United States is helping some of these smaller South Asian countries get on their feet and be able to kind of resist Chinese blandishments in various ways. But at the same time, I wouldn't assume that the United States has too many interests at stake in South Asia. I think the smaller countries of South Asia have only flickeringly mattered for the United States in the long run. I don't see that changing particularly over the next year. I mean, even a country like Afghanistan, I mean, you can see how the United States has effectively dropped it like a hot potato and moved on for very negative consequences, not just for Afghanistan, but for the region as a whole. So I wouldn't, put too much emphasis on what the United States is doing. Yes, in as much as it dovetails with India's interests and plans in the region, I think it's something that New Delhi will welcome. But a lot has to be done by India, and that's where I think action should lie.
Right. Ambassador Saran, do you think that, as Professor Raghavan says, that the U.S.'s interest in the region cannot be put too much store by? Would you agree, or do you think it's more significant?
Well, I would be somewhat more nuanced in that respect because, if I look at, for example, the effort put in by the United States to get this 500 million MCC, deal through with Nepal, it's actually seems to indicate that certainly on the periphery of China, U.S. is interested in maintaining and perhaps even expanding its presence, perhaps in consultation or in association with India. But that does speak to an interest. I would also say that there is certainly an interest in the maritime part of South Asia, whether it is Sri Lanka or whether it is the Maldives. I think even though U.S. involvement may not have been so visible, but certainly I think in terms of encouraging India to take a larger role or even working together with Japan in this respect, does seem to indicate that in some respects, the U.S. Is very much interested in what happens in South Asia. Pakistan, did they have a role to play in the change in government? I do not know, but certainly I see an interest on the part of the Pakistan army, and I see an interest on the part of Pakistani elite in keeping, in refurbishing a relationship with the United States. I do perceive that there is a certain sense of discomfort of too much dependence on China. So it is perhaps somewhat more, as I said, at the granular scale, it is a much more nuanced kind of picture, much more, complex kind of picture than I would not say the U.S. has no interest in South Asia. I don't think that would be true.
So that brings me to my next question, Ambassador Saran. And in your latest book, as I said, it's called How China Sees India and the World. It is the authoritative account of the India-China relationship. You've actually said that India has a better chance of meeting that China challenge if it remains committed to the values of its constitution, upholding democratic institutions, investing in its people, celebrating diversity and vibrant plural culture. There have been concerns about the authoritarian moves in India, what is called the autocratization, if you like, hyper-nationalism, the move towards a single party rule, a kind of virtual ring around the media, around NGOs, a foreign policy that is seen much more important for domestic purposes. The question really is this trend going to make it that much more difficult for India to be a South Asian leader, or is it just becoming part of the other South Asian landscape where there are so many other authoritarian leaders?
Well, I don't think it should be our ambition to become a part of that kind of a landscape in South Asia. I think we have always been able to aspire to a leadership position precisely because we have been a vibrant democracy. We have been able to demonstrate our ability to handle incredible plurality, diversity in this country, being able to, despite some setbacks here and there, to be able to maintain, very vibrant political institutions, which are so important in order to anchor the domestic, democratic spirit. So I would say that any kind of, setback to that is actually going to make any aspiration for regional leadership, and I would extend that to even regional and global leadership, if there is a deficit of democracy in India, that has been in a certain sense a USP of India, and if the kind of policies that may be followed, instigate communalism, instigate lack of social cohesion in the country, then it would become very difficult to really run any kind of foreign policy, because if you're going to be so much preoccupied with your own domestic crises, whether they are economic crises, social crises, or political crises, then how do you play an external role? That is something which should be quite apparent. And I would repeat something that I had also earlier said, that it is very important that you should not let domestic political compulsions begin to influence your external policies, which should be based on a much more, shall I say, a sober calculation of our national interests. I know it is very difficult to have that kind of a clear division between neighborhood policy and domestic policy, but that effort has to be made, because any attempt to try and have a foreign policy that really is aligned with our national interests, with our security interests, it is good to be able to keep the domestic political compulsions aside.
All right. Short of that kind of outcome where there's so much, communalization inside India, it becomes difficult for India to deal with its neighborhood the same way. Professor Raghavan, do you think an authoritarian regime in India or an increasing autocratization actually makes any difference to the region? Are regional players countries in the region actually looking to India for that leadership?
Well, whether countries in the region are looking to India for the leadership or not depends on the quality of India's democratic growth, its economic prosperity, and so on. But I think the more important question is about that we need to recognize that, the ethnic landscape of South Asia does not follow its political boundaries. We may assume that there are some things that we do in India which are purely aimed at domestic audience, but it will have a knock-on impact in terms of how our neighbors perceive it, how they react to it. And we've seen it not just today, but over the decades. So for instance, if the Indian government decides to pursue a certain kind of amendment to the Citizenship Act, it is bound to have implications and consequences across the region. If religious majoritarianism under the sort of name of electoral dominance is given free license in India, you can be almost sure that it will have negative consequences in other parts of the region. And I think there's just no escaping this because the ethnic sort of map of South Asia is not exactly aligned with its political map. And the destiny of the region in some deeper sense actually hangs together. So I think it's very important, therefore, that we realize that not only is it not possible to ring fence our domestic politics and foreign policy, but our domestic politics has a direct repercussion on our ability to play a constructive role in the region. So does our economic policy, actually. I mean, and I think at this point of time, India's economic position clearly is in no shape to enable it to play a serious leadership role in the region. So I think we need a real stock taking of where we are and where we want to go within South Asia as well.
All right, then that really does lead to the last question I had for both of you. We're looking at the eighth year of NOSOC summit. BIMSTEC has met, but it doesn't seem to have much ripple effect really in the region. BBIN is a really tiny subgroup, and even going by that small ambition has not brought everyone on board when it comes, for example, to the motor vehicle agreement. So my question is, what does India need to do to reimagine its region as a whole? Does it need a new organization? Does it need a broader swathe of countries to be included? What does it need to do, Professor Raghavan?
Well, in terms of what policies it should follow, I'll lead Ambassador Saran to sort of, you know, talk about it. He's much more conversant. But I think there is got to be a broader shift in the way that we think about the region. For instance, there are deeper challenges that, you know, we are only now coming to grips with. Climate change, for instance. You know, Ambassador Saran has written about this in the past, that the environmental destiny of South Asia hangs or falls together. Again, just like, you know, the question about ethnicity, these are not things that can be segregated into national boundaries and their effects can be controlled. So when we are thinking about these kinds of challenges which lie ahead of us and are going to be extremely severe for this region, and South Asia is very vulnerable to the sort of, you know, changing sort of problems brought about by climate change, we have to take a broader view of what we want to do and what kinds of challenges the region faces beyond political compulsions of the here and now. Similarly, I would say that, you know, the conversation also needs to broaden out and deepen out beyond just the government level. I think we need a much more deeper engagement at the level of civil society, even at very localized kind of levels between India and its neighbors, because only then will we be able to act in ways that are meaningful to the peoples of the region as a whole.
All right. Ambassador Saran, I'll leave that last word to you. Then what does India need to do to reimagine this South Asian region?
Well, I would like to endorse what Srinath just said. On BBIN, you know, when we don't have South Asia-wide, you know, cooperation in any form, I think we should welcome BBIN, even if it is not a particularly ambitious, you know, project. The fact is that, for example, with respect to the energy market, it has made substantive progress, particularly with respect to Nepal, Bhutan, and Bangladesh. I mean, we are a major supplier of power now to Bangladesh. More recently, there has been also progress in terms of inland water transportation and in trying to revive river navigation in the Northeast, both for Bangladesh as well as for India's whole Northeast. So we should welcome, you know, these modest achievements, I would say, but they at least point to, you know, the potential for regional cooperation to deliver benefits all around. Now, with regard to how we should be, you know, taking regional cooperation forward, I do not think that the current sort of approach of marginalizing SAARC and, you know, trying to give priority to BIMSTEC is such a good idea. I'm not saying that BIMSTEC should not be pursued. Please pursue it for its own merits. But I think that cannot be a substitute for a regional, South Asia regional, you know, cooperative forum. I mean, in that respect, in the absence of any other platform, I think SAARC is still the best platform to try and pursue such regional cooperation, even though it is somewhat hard. The other aspect, of course, is that India being the largest country in the region, actually that asymmetry of power, whether it is economic power or political power or military power, that is actually an asset. Because I have argued in the past that even if India were to open up its market to whatever our neighbors are able to produce and sell, it will still be a tiny fraction of the Indian market. Even if you said, as far as the transport network is concerned, that our neighbors can use any transportation network that they wish for trading with each other or doing their export-import trade, would it really in any way overburden our transportation network? It would not. So the idea should be, how do we work out policies which then present India as the preferred partner for our region, for all our neighbors? How do we ensure that India, in a true sense, using that asymmetry, becomes a real engine of growth for the entire region? Well, that is the future that we should be looking for. Thank you.
Right. And on that note, I will leave this very, very interesting conversation. India must accept its geography, seek to derive from the benefits of the asymmetry in the region, but above all, stay very engaged in South Asia. I'd like to thank Ambassador Shyamsaran, Professor Srinath Raghavan for joining us. If you've been listening, this is The Hindus, The Parley podcast. Thank you for joining us.